Hey folks, thanks for tuning in. My name is Galen Lowe with the Digital Project Manager. We are a community of digital professionals on a mission to help each other get skilled, get confident, and get connected so that we can amplify the value of project management in a digital world. If you want to hear more about that, head on over to thedigitalprojectmanager.com/membership. Okay, today we're talking about the role of behavioral science in project management, how it impacts our beloved project methodologies, and why it could become an important part of the future of project management. Joining me today is Dr. Josh Ramirez, the CEO of the Institute for Neuro and Behavioral Project Management. Josh, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for the invitation. This is going to be fun.
I think it's going to be amazing. So Josh and I, we've been gabbing before recording this, and just this notion of behavioral project management, I think really piqued my interest. I thought, you know what, our listeners are going to really eat this up. If nothing else, it's going to spin up a debate. So I'm really excited to get into it. I guess, first of all, it's kind of an interesting combination. And I'm wondering if maybe you could share the same origin story you shared with me when we were prepping for this, of like how you got into project management, and then how you got from project management into pursuing your doctorate in behavioral science, and then also what that formed and how that formed the Institute for Neuro and Behavioral Project Management.
Yeah, so it was a really interesting story because I was in project management, mostly in Department of Energy, mega projects, et cetera, project controls. It's a lot of cost and schedule, right? And my friend, Dr. Jody Wilson, who I had known, she was a behavioral scientist. And so I would see all these things like, you know, people are planning optimistically, we're always behind schedule. And I was trying to figure it out. And I would ask Jody, I'd be like, you know, what's going on here? Is this like a human behavior thing or something? And she would kind of point to her head and say, do they have one of these, you know, referring to, do you have a brain, right? And I was like, well, I guess they do, you know? She's like, well, then it's a behavioral problem, right? So everything's a behavioral problem for the most part. But yeah, so she'd give me some words. She'd be like, you know, have you heard of cognitive biases? I was like, I don't know. And then she'd give me a couple. I'd go look them up on Wikipedia, and I'd just do some mad searching and find things like, oh, the planning fallacy. That's a cognitive bias that explains the tendency to underestimate durations. I'm like, what? This is all the stuff I was looking for, right? So then I'd dig a little bit deeper. And so I'd ask her more questions. And I was considering my PhD at the time, and I didn't know which direction to go. And she's like, well, have you considered this program at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology? And I looked at it and I was like, this is it, right? This is what I was looking for. And so essentially my dissertation ended up being studying the integration of behavioral science with project management. So my dissertation is titled Toward a Theory of Behavioral Project Management. And so you go a little bit further on that. I was on a plane ride for our first time on a family vacation to Hawaii, and I was studying my behavioral economics class, and then it hit me. Behavioral economics. They integrated behavioral science with economics to create behavioral economics. And I'm trying to figure out what this thing is between behavioral science and project management. And I'm like, is there a behavioral project management already? And I was like, it was like 2 or 3 more hours before we landed, and I'm just like sitting there without internet access thinking, like I have to check, right? Like as soon as I land, is this a thing? So it was a nerve-wracking couple hours. I landed. First thing I did was Google it. There was no behavioral project management. And I'm like, facepalm, are you serious? So that essentially led to my paper or my dissertation for my PhD, Toward a Theory of Behavioral Project Management, founding the Institute for Neuro and Behavioral Project Management, and then creating our certification course, which is called NeuralPlan. So it just kind of all came together. Jody was at the very beginning of that. She essentially introduced me to the topic that led to us developing this discipline.
I love that story. And I love how, you know, somehow the best ideas always happen when you're dreaming in the shower or on an airplane where you can't really do anything about it other than like maybe scribble it on a napkin. No, it's incredible. I mean, like, what year is this? What year did you found the Institute?
So we founded the Institute in 2018. I was started my research in 2016.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. It's like, it's such interesting timing and framing because, you know, I think it's around that time and even still now, it's still sort of progressing this sort of appreciation of the human element in project management. Not all these processes and inputs and outputs necessarily, those are all important too. But usually the problems you run into aren't really necessarily, you know, about that document you created that's probably pristine and perfect. You know, so humans that mess it up. And I say that kindly.
You know, and you say talk about methodologies, and we'll get into it in a minute. But just to kind of bring it into the picture, it's about designing project management around the brain. So sometimes it just means your methodologies are updated to account for that.
I wonder if maybe you could kind of give us a few examples of like what behavioral project management entails for you, and maybe even just like some places where it's being practiced today, you know, with help from the Institute.
It is an emerging discipline. So we've got, I would say, in terms of practicing, you know, we've had a few pilot studies out there that I've done. A big one was in Department of Energy, where we got about an 80% improvement in planning reliability and essentially meeting milestones more. Of course, we have our NeuroPlan practitioners out there who are certified and practicing. And so they're starting to develop their own models as well. But yeah, so when we think of project management, we think of, you know, like old school project management from waterfall would be like, you know, you have initiating phase, planning, executing, monitor, control, close. But from a behavioral standpoint, we look at it from where can you design around the brain? And so we've got more like modalities of behavioral PM. So right now, from what we see, there are four major ones, which are processes, interfaces, such as software, metrics, and skills. And so typically when we think of behavioral science, we would think, oh, it's kind of like sit on the couch and tell me how you feel type deal, right? Emotional intelligence, good communication. Yeah, that's all part of behavioral science too, but that's like maybe 20% of it. The other part of that is you can use behavioral science to essentially design your processes. So when I say the four modalities of behavioral PM, processes, interfaces, metrics, and skills, typically when we think of behavioral science, we only think of it in the skills category, right? Like teach me how to be a better leader, or teach me how to, you know, communicate better or de-bias myself, for example. Okay, that's great. That's just the skills portion. What about your software? You can design your processes and your software that are more centered around human behavior to account for human behavior and thinking errors, for example. You can change your metrics. You can design your procedures and your processes to take certain steps, right, that you would maybe not have had in there otherwise, but behavioral science has shown you that you need this additional step to get more reliability. So it's a very broad range. I mean, there's nudging, there's choice architecture, all the things that maybe some people have heard of before. You can plug that in various modalities.
I love that. I'm going to get you to give some examples in a little bit, but what I'm really interested in is that, you know, coming into this, I was thinking, I'm like, okay, is behavioral project management going to, you know, be this new methodology? You know, is it going to try and get, you know, in the ring with the sort of waterfall agile, you know, debate, or is it something different? Is it like a philosophy or a framework? But like, I love that you use the word design, especially when you said process design. I'm like, oh yeah, it's like, I don't know, in my head, I'm thinking it's another layer. It's like another step. You could be using whatever approach, whatever methodology, but when it comes down to really detailing how the project's going to go, how these processes are going to go, how we're interfacing with software, like what that experience is like, that's when we layer in this sort of the behavioral side of things.
Right. We say behavioral PM isn't going to replace waterfall. It's not going to replace agile. Essentially, what it's going to do is embed behavioral science in every methodology. Because humans, we are humans. We have human behavior. We have cognition, thinking. And so essentially, every methodology that we use, there is a human involved. So essentially, a behavioral PM becomes the foundation upon which other technical disciplines can continue to build, because many things that are common to all humans will be common throughout all methodologies. So behavioral PM is not one of those things you could say, well, okay, now I'm going to stop using Agile because I've adopted behavioral PM. No, you're actually going to use behavioral PM with all of those methodologies, and eventually they will be embedded in all those methodologies. And I'll give you an example, behavioral economics, because you know, behavioral economics has been around for, you know, a couple of decades. And essentially what they did is when they inserted behavioral science into the technical discipline of economics, what they found is that it called into question many traditional theories in economics, because economics essentially just assumed that all beings were just rational and, you know, perfect decision makers, right? So in behavioral economics, they call that fictitional person homo economicus, which is essentially means, you know, it's this person that doesn't exist that makes perfect decisions. And so when you insert behavioral science into it, what you find is that it upends many of the traditional technical theories that we assumed. It'll do the same thing with project management, and it'll enable us to essentially kind of clean up some of the complication. You know, behavioral science, you think, well, we're going to adopt this new discipline, it's going to make it more complex. Actually, as a cognitive scientist, I'm going to tell you, our idea is actually to make things more simple. because that enables the brain to process better.
In my head, I'm thinking, I'm like, okay, well, throughout all of this, like, how much is actually up to the project manager in this scenario? I think a lot of our listeners might be like, okay, well, I'm not going to like start from scratch and rewrite every process for every project to account for human behavior differently. Is this something where, you know, like the sort of neural PMs and the folks that you certify and folks just practicing this, like, is that what they're doing? Are they going, okay, well, listen, I need to redesign a project process with humans in mind, and I'll use these guiding principles, but fundamentally, it's another sort of stream of work that I need to do to make sure my project goes well? Or is it maybe, you know, more collaborative or bigger than just the responsibility of the project manager?
Yeah, it's definitely bigger than the responsibility of just the PM. As a matter of fact, I think one of the biggest places that we'll probably see the first changes will be in the PMO, right? Another name for that is what we're calling is more of a behavioral PMO. So it's like, the PMO is where you would probably start. It's essentially, that's where you start to kind of roll out some of those changes, right? And sometimes it's completely up to the organization itself outside of the control of the PM in terms of designing that cognitive environment. So for example, time pressure causes us to think more automatically. We already think automatically 95% of the day, and that causes the brain to go what behavioral scientists call system one, which is, if you ever read the book Thinking Fast and Slow, that's that same concept. So essentially, when we're under time pressure, we think faster. And when we think faster, we're not thinking as thoroughly. And so what that does is it causes us to use the brain's heuristic system, which makes us default certain directions. Sometimes those directions are not good, right? For example, we may default to the most obvious answer, or we default to something that can quickly come to mind. So that would be more heuristic based. And when we default to those, we actually rely on more cognitive biases to do our decision making in project management. So by default, in a sense, if you look at project management in its definition, it's a temporary endeavor to deliver a product or service. Temporary endeavor creates time pressure. Time pressure creates system one. System one causes potential more thinking errors, and that essentially increases your risk and causes schedule delays and cost overruns. So back to how the organization can control that is, the organization can control time pressure. The organization can control cognitive load or psychological safety. So it's not just in the PM's hands.
That's fair. No, and I like that in terms of like the overarching, you know, body or centralized project management, you know, office or whatever you call it at your organization. I wonder, maybe you can kind of like walk through an example, because I like that idea. And I know I've been in projects where, you know, we kind of recognize that we're like good enough, right? We'll say things like, okay, yeah, you know, good enough for this, good enough for that. We're going, you know, we're using the sort of fast think heuristics view of the world. We're probably leveraging on, you know, unconscious bias, maybe conscious bias. We're kind of shortcutting our way through. And then when I like rewind, I'm like, I think that's what a lot of project managers, myself included, kind of think our job is, right? Is like, we have time pressure and we have to manage time pressure. Time pressure is almost a constant. It's going to exist. And yet, you know, what does a world look like where we allow our teams to not work under this sort of time pressure? What does that look like and how does it work?
I think in terms of time pressure, what you have to realize is it's where you're using time pressure and the level of time pressure. Some time pressure is okay. Extreme time pressure is going to get you more defaulted thinking, right? So it's not only how much time pressure, but when. So if you're doing things that require a lot of predictability, so for example, if you're talking anything predictive, such as creating a plan, which is predictive, if you are doing risk identification, that's predictive, right? If you're doing resource estimation, also predictive. Those are predictive things. Anytime you're doing anything predictive, you should be reducing time pressure specifically in those areas. If you're just looking at monitoring, controlling, and you're just, you know, getting feedback and creating reports, maybe time pressure can be a little higher then, right? Because it's more reactive than it is predictive. But if you're doing anything predictive, time pressure should be lower then, because essentially that's when you become more defaulted in your thinking.
I remember, and I wish I had this conversation with you like 12 years ago, because we, you know, I've worked on a couple of projects where, you know, there's a lot of technical complexity or ambiguity. We don't really know what the solution is. Or, you know, in service design where, you know, we want to do the research and take the time to find the right, you know, solution. We're going through this like double diamond design thinking process kind of thing, right? Where, you know, as a project manager, I'm like, okay, well, is 2 weeks enough for that? And they're like, well, I don't know, how long is enough to solve a problem that has never been solved before? And it was really difficult to sell through, like, oh, we're going to do a month of R&D. And you know, our clients would be like, what? What do you mean? Like, can't you just, like, don't you just know how to do this? And I would have loved to have had that argument up my sleeve to be like, well, you know, we can think fast, you know, and rely on our assumptions and produce the wrong thing, or we can, you know, reduce the time pressure, you know, take the time, do the slow thinking, like remove some of our biases and come up with a better result because this has never been done before. Like, I think that would actually land, you know, not for every client. I think a lot of our listeners will be like, yeah, my client would just be like, just do it in a week. But I like the argument of like, it's going to be better because this is how our brain works. Not because we have more time to sit around and have a Don Draper nap and think about it, that too, but also our brain is in a different mode. Like we are thinking about it a different way. That's the benefit.
Yeah. And you know, there's often some assumptions like, and this is where the biased thinking comes in is, yeah, but I think better under time pressure, right? Yeah, sure. Okay. If you want to believe that, yep. Or all I need is a couple good cups of coffee and that's going to reduce my cognitive load. Sorry that brain doesn't work that way, you know? And so if you realize that a lot of these things are common to all human beings, and that there's neuroscience behind a lot of it as well, then you can kind of learn to accept that, hey, you know what? We all kind of have these same kind of brain functions. And so we all have to account for them. There's none of us that are special. What makes us more special and skilled in that area is knowing how it affects us so that we can calibrate that.
I just like the thematic tie as well, because I mean, especially project managers, right? Like, you know, we're talking about, you know, quote unquote, old school models of project management. And not that long ago, right? A lot of project managers thought their role was to just get it done on time, right? Like, so if you can get it done fast, then that's good. And more we're realizing that, you know, our role is actually to, you know, A, manage a team of humans that probably don't always work together. So I can see how behavioral science could be handy there. But also we're responsible for delivering value. So thinking fast and getting it done and checking something off a list doesn't mean good enough anymore. Before I could say, yeah, I got it done on time and I'm a project manager and that's all that really matters. It's under budget or it's on budget. We didn't do anything extra, no gold plating, like it's perfect. But if it's the wrong thing and we didn't take the time to actually create the environment for someone to come up with a better solution, then is that really success? And that's what I like about sort of the, you know, the behavioral science lens to all of this.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and kind of echoing some of that on another pilot study I did, I found that about 65% of our schedule delays were actually predictable and preventable. And just to pull the string on one of those, what I found is in some cases, that predictable event that we misforecasted essentially had waste inside of it. So for example, team A is on location and doing their thing. Team B forecasted that next week they're going to be at that same location, except they didn't bother to pick up the phone to see if team A was going to be in the spot where they needed to be. Team B then shows up where team A is working and can't work. Where's the waste? Well, the waste is in now team B has to redeploy to another project because this is the one they had planned. If they can redeploy to another project, assume it takes them, you know, another day before they can start another project. Essentially, you've got my particular example, six guys and gals who show up at, you say, a burdened rate of $100 an hour, right? And they're going to have an 8-hour day. Essentially, you just wasted, you know, $5,000 in downtime because you made a bad prediction. So planning is just essentially anything predictive. Anytime you're making a prediction is planning, whether you're predicting what you will do tomorrow or predicting what you do a month from now. And there's waste involved with not thinking and using that debiasing technique to predict and plan your work, because planning is really predictive coordination, right? We're predictively coordinating where things need to be by a particular time. And so good planning and good prediction essentially goes back to the brain, because the brain is essentially doing imagination in order to imagine what we will do tomorrow, for example, because you're not actually doing it. There's nothing physical to represent it. So it's all mental processing. Planning is essentially an exercise in imagination. And so any weaknesses of the brain essentially become a weakness in prediction. And that causes waste and cost overrun. And of course, schedule delays and risk.
So maybe talk to me about some of the fixes. You had mentioned a couple of things earlier and in our previous conversations. The two that I latched onto were nudging and I think what you called obstacle identification. And I'm wondering if we could sort of apply this to planning and time pressure, especially that scenario of like, you know, if only we had done X or Y, this team wouldn't have just, you know, been sitting on their hands all day and we'd have $5,000 in our pocket.
So obstacle identification. So there's research in planning on the behavioral side that shows that when you identify obstacles to the task or activity completion prior to, this is the key because of the anchoring effect bias, prior to making an estimate of resources or estimate of time, then the reliability of your plan goes up. In other words, you will deliver more on what you said you would do. So the key there is you're kind of forcing the brain to look at what gets in the way of completing this work. And the key is doing it prior to actually starting it, right? Because once you start it, now you're going to run into the obstacles versus, you know, getting a chance to deal with them in advance. But there's little kind of tricks in behavioral science and some things that are kind of really subtle and they seem mundane, but because we don't use them, we're not as effective, right? And so this also goes back to the kind of project science evidence-based side of project management, which is we're not using a lot of evidence-based studies to develop our project management methodologies. So if you look at something like obstacle identification, essentially what the study found is that you got more reliable execution by identifying obstacles prior to estimating anything. And it's really kind of common sense when you think about it, except for if we're not doing it, then we're not getting the results, right? And then so you mentioned nudging or choice architecture, also very subtle. So for example, they did a study in, I forget which country it was, but essentially what they were looking at was how do we increase organ donation? And what they found is that they changed the defaults in terms of when people would, you know, sign up to get their license or whatever they would do, they would change the defaults in the program from opting in to opting out. So I have to take an extra step in order to opt out, which that interferes with our human inertia. And we don't like taking extra steps, right? So we still give them the choice, but it's the defaults that have been switched. So essentially what they did is when they switched it from I have to opt in to organ donation to I have to opt out of organ donation, like the organ donation just went through the roof. I mean, it was just like crazy increase. And it's like, well, you know, you could have left it at opt in, but spend all this extra energy marketing, begging people to opt in, you know, blah, 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 blah. And all we needed to do was just make a default switch, right? And that's just one example of nudging. So if you combine all these different types of behavioral strategies into project management, what you get is you get defaulted better decision-making in the end.
Let me play it back to you and see if I'm understanding this correctly, because in some ways, obstacle identification, like I'm thinking of it as similar to risk management, I guess, right? Like what could go wrong? What could go terribly right, I guess. But I think in some ways, risk management has a bad rap because, you know, as soon as you say it, you know, across multiple industries, it's not anyone's favorite thing necessarily, right? Oh, we're going to do risk identification. Boring. Like this sounds terrible and cynical. But, you know, using your sort of nudging example, like kind of reframing a question to make it easier, you know, I'm thinking about things like, you know, the question of when do you think you could get this done by, which is a common thing to ask when we're planning, we're estimating, right? Which is a very pressurized question, right? Which is like when everyone throws up their hands and say, you know, estimation is a joke, humans suck at planning, yada, yada, yada. All those things are probably actually true. But, you know, versus the question of, I don't know, like what might prevent you from getting this done, you know, in the best way possible? What has to go right, I guess, in order for this to give you the best probability of succeeding at delivering this thing? Is that kind of the right idea in terms of like a nudge that's framed differently and an exercise in like obstacle identification so that we can just kind of, you know, unpack differently and maybe just use the parts of our brain that are a bit more imaginative and creative instead of the, you know, the fast brain that's just, you know, let's get this estimate done because we need to get it out the door and it's going to be terrible anyways.
So yeah, obstacle identification is one of those easy ones because essentially what you're doing is kind of forcing the brain to look at things from different perspectives. But obstacle identification is also different from risk from a human behavior perspective. And so I often get the question, you know, well, why would I start identifying obstacles when I already do risk? Well, two reasons. But one of the big reasons is that the brain looks at risk different than it looks at obstacles. Because risk, in many cases, is essentially this bad thing that may or may not occur. obstacles are one of those things I have to overcome. And it's something that will occur. Obstacles do occur. Risks may or may not occur. How is that different to the brain? Well, to the brain, something bad that may or may not occur, I can assign a low probability to, or just strike it from the risk register because it's mentally uncomfortable. If I say it may or may not occur, my brain, to deal with the cognitive dissonance, as we call it, may say, I just really think that there's not a high probability of this happening. You know why? Because I want to reduce the mental discomfort associated with that risk.
I don't want to think about it.
And so risk is essentially giving me an opt-out opportunity, an opportunity to say that risk is not that important, low probability, or I'm just going to strike it from the risk register. If I ask you to identify obstacles, those are things that will occur. I do have to overcome them. And sometimes it can even, there's a little bit of gamification in there as well. Obstacle identification, it's like, well, I have the opportunity to essentially solve this problem. Right. So there is a big difference between risk and obstacles. You still need to identify risks. I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm just saying that identifying obstacles is different.
No, I'm glad you clarified that because, in my head, I was like, obstacles, you can kind of walk around. I'm picturing this like obstacle course, one of those ridiculous game shows. You're just like, I'll just walk around it. But actually, this is the course. You have to go through these things and they're like, going through the different various whatever levels. Like, it's the process. And actually, it kind of gives credit to the process too, not what's going to go wrong that keeps you from doing, the thing that's just your job, versus saying like, okay, your job is tough. Like, tell me about like what obstacles, like what hard steps do you need to cross in order to get this done so that we can understand better and actually probably inform the risk management process as well to be like, okay, all the ambiguous stuff that we don't know, those are risks, but the stuff that we do know, like, we'll treat them as obstacles because, the job you're doing is difficult, is specialized, is multi-step. It's multifaceted. It's not, drawing a straight line with a pencil on a piece of paper. There's some complexity to it. And it kind of addresses that. And I guess it is like, the opt-in model.
Yeah. And you can create activities for those obstacles too. I mean, if there's a major obstacle, you create an activity to overcome it, So there's options.
I like this. Yeah. In my framing and my understanding, it's kind of like, there's a layer of sort of, process design doesn't give it enough credit, I guess. But to your point, when people think of behavioral science and project management, often they think about, this like traditionally what people might call quote unquote like soft skills, sit on the couch, talk about our feelings, and not necessarily, getting the work done. But actually, this is different. This is actually designing a process with the human brain in mind, knowing what the human brain is actually quite bad at and finding ways to hack it, for lack of a better word, into better planning, better predictability, and just overall less cognitive dissonance with the humans that are trying to get the project done. You mentioned software and like interfacing earlier. And just to kind of give that some context, I had a guest on the podcast a couple of years back, Bensi Goldman. Check out that episode. Pretty good. And it was kind of about that. It was nudges around a kind of like a feedback and giving people an opportunity and framing the question in the right way that it wasn't necessarily loaded to sort of embed that into the software experience, right? You're like managing your project or you're managing your work. And these things will just kind of like layer in and pop up at the right times, in some cases in a way that is more relaxed rather than, very time pressure oriented. But like, is that something that your institute does, is looking into in terms of like layering onto software so that this is actually kind of like out of the box? Project managers might not have to worry about this that much. They might want to understand it, but they might not have to design all the nudges and design all the processes themselves.
Yes, that, as a matter of fact, we're starting to work with a software company right now, which is looking into that very process, which is essentially, how do we take behavioral science and behavioral PM and plug that into software development? Because every step along the way, you can change defaults, you can add processes like, for example, obstacle identification, combine that with AI and prompts, and there's all kinds of stuff you can do, right? And so if you look at just the example of the pilot study that I did where we essentially improve planning accuracy and the reliability of meeting that milestone, you're taking those same steps and essentially you're just plugging them into the software versus, the person have to be in the meeting coaching them through that. The software essentially becomes the coach. And the nice thing about a lot of this is, although awareness of cognitive biases and thinking errors, et cetera, is important, that's part of the process. Like, if I teach you about optimism bias, you're likely to, try to account for that in many cases. because your brain's just got, now that it knows about it. So awareness is a good piece, and you should always have the awareness piece as well. But there's also the other part of it, which is just pure design, which is I'm just designing steps into the software or into your procedures, which cause you to make better decisions, right? So it's kind of a multifaceted approach. But the nice thing about the one experiment I did is I didn't do any teaching about biases. All I did was use behavioral design. And so I still got good results by essentially designing better decision-making into the steps without having to train them on what cognitive biases were going on, right? So there's many ways to approach it.
I love that layering. And I think, you know, probably our listeners are thinking that too. Like, how do I get started? Yes, probably awareness of biases and just reading up on behavioral science overall, you know, maybe lensing behavioral economics through a project management lens and kind of understanding what that means. But I like the idea as well that a process that's designed well does not rely on everyone having the same level of understanding or awareness of the science behind it. They just kind of like get to experience it, live it, and the impact is still going to be the same without like this huge learning curve.
So obviously you're going to be much better if you have both the awareness component and the design component, but it's not like you have to get started by knowing everything.
Fair enough. I thought maybe I'd dive into some tough stuff. Some of the tough questions. Those are the softballs. No, I think it gave really good context. I think it's really interesting.
Wait, I think I have a phone call coming in.
The line's breaking up. You know, I mentioned it earlier, just the fact that project managers, we've been debating things like waterfall versus agile for like over 20 years. We're not exactly like the group of people that's like the most open to change. Or if we are, it's very hard for us to agree on things. I like this idea of behavioral project management, but I'm wondering, like, could it become equally as like divisive? Like, and if so, what are the implications of behavioral project management being like adopted and practiced?
Yeah, so I don't think that it will become more divisive, because essentially what we're doing compared to some of the older methodologies, which were less evidence-based, although I have to caveat that by saying Agile does have a whole lot more evidence-based stuff, and it's kudos to them. But I think part of the reason why we have these arguments all the time, one is time pressure causes automatic thinking, which causes more of that. But two, it's because a lot of methods are evidence-based. So essentially, in many cases, we haven't found what's most effective. We're just kind of guessing at it sometimes. And so when you're guessing at it, then it becomes more a fight of opinions. But if you're using things that are kind of more, and I say proven very lightly because as behavioral scientists, we hate using that word. But I would say more evidence-based, right? You've got more evidence that something worked because you tested it. And so when you bring in more science-backed processes, there's less room to debate if they work, right? And so that, I think, kind of reduces some of the potential in terms of, well, you know, which method is better, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to say, well, if you use obstacle identification, it's going to work in Agile or waterfall, and you're going to find more obstacles. Like, I don't know what else to tell you. I mean, right, you know, it's simple things like that. You know, if you change your defaults, you're going to get results. If you do unpacking, which is proven in cognitive science, not only beneficial for planning and risk, but also for safety and personal decision making, right? You add in all those kind of components, a lot of them are just kind of like, yeah, I mean, there's really nothing to argue about there.
Fair enough. And actually, you know, even coming back to your story at the beginning with Jody, right? It's like a lot of the arguments are around the idea that projects are, you know, special snowflakes. They're all unique. And actually, you know, they are, but
there's a uniqueness bias for that too, by the way, but go ahead.
Ooh, okay. I want to hear more about that. But I mean, the thing that you said that Jody had said to you, which is that, well, the common denominator is that these are people with brains doing a thing together. So, I mean, that part is not unique. That part is pretty much a constant throughout our projects, at least for now, until the robots catch up. Right now, we're dealing with human brains, human behavior. Doesn't matter what methodology you're using, some of the problems you run into aren't because of the methodology at all. And then we have all of these fights over anecdotal, quote unquote, evidence. Well, I saw another company do that and it failed. It fell on its face. Agile sucks. Like, it's not going to work. Waterfall sucks. It doesn't work for us. Yeah, it's like we might actually be arguing about the wrong thing, actually. We could be agreeing on the fact that humans are the ones that we need to kind of account for a little bit more.
Yeah, here's a perfect example in the federal projects environment. What you find is there's a lot of earned value compliance measures. And earned value compliance has in it buried a lot of stuff that become counterproductive to good decision making. But why did earned value compliance become so popular? Why did it become so used and regulated? And the idea is that, well, I just need to have everything. I need to be able to see everything and monitor everything. And it's like, well, I understand that, but you're going to such a level of depth that you're causing cognitive load, you're causing bad planning, you're not using visualizations as much, et cetera, right? And so you find that, well, we threw in the whole toolbox hoping that something would work. But what you found out was that you didn't need 1,000 tools from the toolbox. You needed 1/3-inch socket, right? And so the evidence-based stuff essentially points you to get the right tool for the right job.
That's fair, yeah. It's an interesting one because I'm thinking about, you know, just like, yeah, the culture of earned value, especially in like, you know, you mentioned government, like public sector, and it's kind of like this sort of scrutiny around taxpayer dollars. And we want to make sure that no one's gaming the system, which then causes people to game the system, right? It's like, there's the human brain for you. It's like, okay, you gave me a set of rules. Let me see how I can bend them.
Right.
I mentioned earlier about just software, but also, you know, AI and how generative AI and LLMs are kind of, you know, coming into the forefront. And we're talking about that a lot, you know, in project management. Arguably, there's someone who might come in and say, well, listen, like, that's all fine, Josh, but, you know, isn't it more important that we understand technology more than we understand some of this human behavior stuff? Because, you know, fundamentally, they're going to be sort of making the decisions and doing a lot of these things themselves. You know, why should we bother designing these processes for the human brain? Like, what would you say to that?
Ooh, that's a deep one. I got a lot on that one. So first of all, as AI comes into the picture, AI will start handling more of the mundane tasks, right? What does that leave PMs with? More decision making. So instead of doing less decision making because of AI, they're doing more decision making, right? Because now AI is handling all the mundane tasks. What does that leave me with? I don't handle as much of the mundane tasks. So I can't run on system one as much as I used to. Now I'm forced to think in system two, which is more deliberate and thoughtful, which means what? I have to have more behavioral strategies to essentially clear my thinking up. So actually, with AI coming into the picture, we need behavioral science more, not less. Also, AI will have to eventually, and some of it's already being done, have to be designed around the brain and debiasing. And when I say biasing, I'm not talking stereotypes or prejudice. I'm talking about just plain thinking errors like the planning fallacy, which is the tendency to underestimate durations, right? So essentially, with AI coming to the picture, behavioral science becomes actually pretty much center to everything. Because if AI can handle some of the mundane project management tasks, now it's up to us as decision makers to use clear thinking. The other thing is, if you have to look at ChatGPT, for example, as a simple example, or any generative AI where you're doing prompting, your prompt and how you ask the question will essentially get better or worse answers from the generative AI. So if I'm asking generative AI to unpack my tasks, that's the right ask, and I'm going to get better results. If I ask them to identify obstacles, I'm going to get better results from the AI, right? And also, AI can become a coach eventually in the future, where AI is essentially looking at the rest of our systems or past projects, and it says, what about this, right? And so it's pulling up this reference class forecast, which says, well, in the past, you've benchmarked and done the X in a certain amount of time. What say you, human, right? And so in which case now the human has to have a better thinking skills to essentially, for lack of a better word, converse with the AI and get better decisions, right? Because now they're going to be presented with a scenario, in which case, once again, they have to make an unbiased decision. So if there's cognitive dissonance associated with that, which is mental discomfort associated with conflicting values or beliefs, that's a mentally uncomfortable thing. I don't want to talk about it, right? But AI is bringing you something that you have to face. How are you going to deal with it? The other thing is that AI can help in reframing. And so reframing is a big thing in behavioral science because, and I tried it in ChatGPT, I said, give me a list of risks for this associated work. It gave me a list of risks. How did AI give me the list of risks? Well, it gave it to me in kind of a scary sort of, you know, here's all the things that could go wrong. And I said, hey, ChatGPT, reframe that entire risk list that you gave me in a more positive light so that my stakeholders would be more apt to accept them and mitigate them, right? So essentially, I reduced the cognitive dissonance by using AI so that I could represent to my stakeholders risk in such a light that they would want to resolve them and not run away from them. And so AI did that. So essentially, behavioral science becomes not less used as AI comes into the picture. It becomes the center of everything, essentially.
I love that notion of, like, you know, a prompt is a nudge, actually. And also, you can prompt an AI to reframe something so that it's a little less cognitively dissonant than it was either in your head or out of the LLM, you know, to begin with. I'm super clever. Oh, I wish I had added that into my risk management using AI workshop. Awesome. So I'll end with a question that's a little bit more inspirational and less of a hardball. Given everything we've been talking about around, you know, behavioral project management and its relationship with project methodologies, like, where is the future of project methodologies headed? Do you want to make a few predictions?
So one, I think that the absolute methodologies of waterfall, agile, and everything in between, I think we're already seeing it becoming more hybrid, right? With AI in the picture, it'll start to take over the mundane parts of agile and waterfall. And that with behavioral science and neuroscience come into the picture, I think that AI mixed with behavioral science will essentially be center and be key. And the methodologies that we use today will essentially, they're not going to go away, but a lot of it will be automated. And so as AI comes into the picture, like I said before, decision-making becomes even more so pushed to the project manager because the PM already has a lot of automation going on. And so now they have to use their brain essentially more than maybe what they're used to in the past. I'm hoping that organizations will also realize that with that comes higher cognitive load. And a higher cognitive load is associated also with system one and heuristics and biases. So I think the future will be really cool in project management because in 10 years, I hope to see it, maybe even 5 years, I hope to see much of our project management software designed around humans. And that a lot of government policy, a lot of procedures, PMOs essentially become more centered around human thinking. Because if we realize anything above everything, projects are by humans for humans. And so if we center our thinking around, hey, it's also the humans we're creating this for, but it's also the humans who are managing it. And there are ways to solve, you know, the 50% of projects that go awry and go over budget and, you know, get behind schedule.
I like that model of where, you know, in the solar system model, actually the behavioral science side of things is the sun. And our methodology can orbit around that, and that's okay. Sometimes you need a gas giant, sometimes you need a terrestrial planet, you know, it's all good. But at the center of it is the humans. And that's what will influence it going ahead.
And realize our brain is not just a feeling machine, it's a thinking machine.
Ooh.
I'm using that as a poll quote for this episode.
Do that. Yeah.
Josh, thanks so much for hanging out with me today. This has been a lot of fun. I found it really insightful. If folks want to learn more about what you do in the Institute, like, where can they go?
So if you go to behavioralpm.com, that's our Institute page. You can also click on the membership tab and become a member for free up there. And then we also have our certification, which is the NeuralPlan NPPQ certification. So if you go to neural-plan.com, it's also there. By the way, you can get certified on a monthly payment plan, by the way, if you're in Canada or the US, obviously subject to eligibility. So that makes it a little bit more convenient. So by the way, Neural is spelled N-E-U-R-A-L. So it's neural-plan.com. So that's our certification as well.
Very cool. I'm going to include all those links in the show notes as well. Thanks again. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure for sure. I appreciate the invitation.
All right, folks, there you have it. As always, if you'd like to join the conversation with over 1,000 like-minded project management champions, come and join our collective. Head on over to thedigitalprojectmanager.com/membership to learn more. And if you like what you heard today, please subscribe and stay in touch on thedigitalprojectmanager.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.